Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches. Hello and welcome to Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in the studio with me today is Dan Drost, USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist. And yes, there's still gardening going on, and we'd like to hear your questions or comments. Toll-free 1-800-826-1495. You can also send us an email question, upraccess@gmail.com. And then if you'd prefer, you can tweet us your question at #AUGarden. Dan, thanks for coming in.
It's good to be here again.
The last week, have been out and about around the southern part of the state and seeing all of the beautiful wonders that this state has to offer, but also looking at gardens as we're driving through communities. It looks like all around a pretty good gardening season.
Yeah, we were a little concerned, I think, halfway through the season when it got dry. If you had water, you were okay. A little bit concerned that maybe it was going to be too hot. There were some gardeners that talked to me and communicated with our extension educators out in the state that they were having problem with fruit set and some of those kinds of things. And often that occurs in things like bean and tomato and eggplant. My eggplants kind of shut down through the middle of the summer, and now they're just really starting to come back into bloom, but that isn't going to do me any good. So we've got small little egg fruits on them and not much that's going to come there. And they were kind of a blind period or a non-fruiting period that was brought on by some of those really high temperatures that we had. You know, we were warm for a long period of time. It was warm overnight. All of those things caused fruiting problems. And now those plants are kind of coming back into their own. And, you know, the season is kind of winding down. We've gone through the harvest moon. Hopefully people got out and had a look at it over the weekend because it was spectacular.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, we're expecting a frost sometime here in the next period of time, whenever that may be, and that's going to kind of determine what happens. You know, we could go into an Indian summer, that they call it, or, you know, a fall period where we have some nice weather, but often we'll get that, you know, first hard frost, and that kind of stops most things, and a few other things keep going, and we've got opportunity there, but we've also got to deal with our climate.
I really noticed that with my beans. I didn't get much in the way of production until about mid-August, and then all of a sudden, boom, and they're still coming on. My wife says, I'm tired of picking beans.
Yeah,
I said, I'm tired of snipping beans. Because we're getting a whole 5-gallon bucket every time we go pick.
That's a lot. I mean,
we eat them all through the winter. So
yeah,
that's
a good thing. I mean, that's the nice thing about it. But yeah, it's that time when they come. It would be nice if we could figure out ways to program plants to kind of just trickle along. You'd get enough for what you need, and then, you know, not too much, and you could program it a little bit more, but we can't do that. So it kind of, they do their thing. And this fall has kind of been one of those where we've just had a bounty of produce coming out of our vegetable gardens, and, you know, it's been nice. We've eaten very well.
You were mentioning peppers.
Actually, last night, you know, we sat out until well after 8 o'clock, ate dinner out on the patio, grilled some red pepper, had that with our meal, had tomatoes and fresh basil, had fresh beans as well with it. So it was basically a garden-based dinner that we had, and we sat out, and the evening was warm, and it was pleasant. There wasn't any breeze, and, you know, you think about it, you know, it's like the last of September, we were commenting, this might be the last time that you really can sit out comfortably without a jacket. I mean, I was in my shorts, short sleeve shirt on, feeling, you know, really nice and saying, hey, you know, this is great, and I hope this lasts for another month.
Enjoy it while you've got it.
Yeah. So I mean, you know, our gardens do what they're supposed to do, but now they're kind of coming back into their own. But a lot of our crops that are coming into their own aren't really going to mature off the fruits that are there. So we're seeing a real second set on our peppers, but the fruits are a little on the small side. They aren't really going to get to the point where they're physiologically mature. We'll be able to harvest them, though. You know, as green peppers, we tried to grow a lot more colored peppers this year. You know, I wanted them really ripe, and I wanted, you know, for grilling purposes, and they were just so sweet. You sit there and you think to yourself, oh, these are lovely. And tomatoes, people are saying, oh, my plants are doing great. I got lots of green tomatoes on them. And I look at my tomato plants, and they are just loaded with green fruits. And so I'm going to have to make some decisions. Either I got to protect them from that first frost that comes in. And that's going to be pretty easy for me because I got them up against the house and they're up against the brick wall. And, you know, I think I can protect them reasonably well and you know, extend the production on them. But if you're out in your garden or if you're in a low-lying area in some area of the state where, you know, you get that early frost, it kind of depends on how hard the frost is, but even if it isn't a hard frost, for some of these warm season veggies, that frost is not a good thing, and it really does impact how that fruit will ripen in the future, and also it'll impact its flavor to a certain extent.
Well, I was seeing a prediction, at least for Hyde Park, for 28, which is, it's not a light frost, so I'm thinking, well, I'm just going to go out and pick.
Yeah.
So as far as looking at things like squash. Let's get the squash picked and in. And so talk about the harvesting technique for squash.
Well, for our winter squash, you know, whether we're talking about bananas or buttercups or butternuts or acorns or, you know, any of those hard shelled types, the key to determining whether they're mature or not is to take your thumbnail and try and scratch the skin. And if you can go and you can peel off a little bit of that skin and it gets under your fingernail, that fruit is physiologically still immature. And you still haven't built up the full complement of sugars in it. Now you can harvest it. It will be edible, but it's not going to maybe be as flavorful as one of those that is more mature. So if you can kind of, when you scratch your finger across it, you make an indentation, but you don't actually peel off any of the skin, those fruits are physiologically mature. So then you want to cut off the fruit from the vine and bring them inside.
Leave a stem on it?
Leave the stem on, because otherwise you have an open section on the end of it where pathogens can start to take hold. Snip off that. So I go out with a shears or a cutters and just cut off and leave a chunk of the stem on it. And then bring it into a warm area for about a week's time. You really want it to be in a quite warm area to help cure that rind, to help cure that cut surface, to also, you know, get some after ripening that goes on in squash, and then we can physically store it. Now, one of the big problems that people have with storing squash is they actually store it too cold. Now, like all of our warm season crops, like tomatoes and things like that, when we store them at a temperature less than their ideal, what we find is that there are cells on the outer skin that are damaged by that cold temperature. And so then the cells start to leak sugars and other metabolites out of those cells, and secondary pathogens come along and start to feed on them, and that's where the rot organisms start to come in. So curing them at a warm temperature for a week or so is a good thing.
To, like, what, just upstairs in the house?
You can't, yeah, if you got a really warm room or someplace, if you've got, you know, a greenhouse or a tunnel house or something like that where it stays pretty warm, put them in there and that will help cure them. The sun isn't going to hurt them any, but it's going to help set the skin on them. Most of us don't have the right curing environment, really. We'd like to store them at about 70 to 80 degrees, constant temperature for a while in order to store the best. We see these farmers that put them out on their fruit stands, and they don't bring them in at night, and so they go from warm temperatures during the day to potentially quite cold temperatures at night. And it's those cold temperatures that cause the injury to the cells that lead to these secondary rot organisms getting a foothold on the fruit and causing rotting to occur. And that rotting doesn't occur very quickly, but about late November, early December, that's when we start seeing that these fruits are starting to deteriorate. So storing them warm, or curing them warm, and then storing them at a warmer temperature. And I always store mine at about 50 to 60 degrees. So most people have the tendency to put them into their fruit room,
yeah,
where it's cold. And it's really 40 degrees in there, or, you know, we'd like it a little bit colder to store things like potatoes and onions and some of those crops that like colder storage conditions. Squash really doesn't like it that way. And if you do that, then you only get more secondary organisms that start to grow on them. They deteriorate more rapidly. And sure, I store quite a bit of squash. We picked ours last week. We had a lot of it for in a trial at the university, and we had way more than we knew what to do with. So I brought some of that home. But now it's being stored in a warm room in my house, in the basement, that's always gets a lot of heat in it and stays a little bit on the warm side. And then I'll be moving it in near my furnace where it stays a little bit warmer in that room there. And now it's not real warm in that room because we don't duct anything in it, but there's enough heat that comes off of my furnace and my hot water heater that that's the appropriate place to store it.
You know, a couple of years ago when you had talked about this and finally the light bulb went on, because I had been having some issues with rotting in my winter squash, I moved them over to the room where I have the boiler and yep, the hot water heater, and they'll last until April.
Yeah, we had squash, you know, we eat a lot of it because we both like it. So it, you know, I never get so much that I have, you know, tons and tons of this stuff, but it always lasts for us well into February. And, you know, we'll probably have squash with a meal. And, you know, it's just Dawn and I, and it's, you know, big squash goes several weeks, you know. So you cook the whole thing up, and then you proportion it out, and you freeze the rest of it that's been cooked, and then it comes back out, and you have it the next week with a meal of some sort. So one squash will last 2 or 3 weeks, depending on its size. And so I need, you know, maybe 20 or 25 squash in my storage. And if I have more than that, it's too much for just the two of us. So as you think about that rotting is what we're trying to avoid. You just spent the whole year growing this crop. Why are you then storing it in the wrong place? Now, the other problem that people have is it's a chilling response that causes these cells on the fruit rind to start to leak. So that's just due to cold. And the temperature that starts to happen at is somewhere around 40 degrees. And so if we have night temperatures that are dropping down to 40 or above freezing, so between 32 and 40, that's a really bad thing for the squash. Now, you hear people say, oh, a little bit of frost to help set the rind on it. Well, it doesn't set the rind. If you frost them and you get frost literally on those cells, that's the worst thing that you can do. So if they're predicting a frost in your area this week, and I heard on the weather last night, we're going to have a cold spell and some of our higher mountain valleys are going to experience frost, you should be harvesting your squash today or tomorrow. You should be pulling them out of the garden, curing them this week, getting them out so that they're not frosted. And by curing them, I don't mean them, put them underneath the tree in the backyard. I mean, you know, literally putting them in your garage to try and minimize the amount of that cold injury on them. And then you'll get this storage of all these nice fruits until, you know, well into the new year and beyond.
So with the squash in my garden, where it has dropped into the upper 30s. Have I already got cold injury?
Well, you may have some, you know, and
I mean,
that's
kind of in a protected area, but
yeah, but you know, still, it's these responses are not like a light switch. They happen or they don't happen, and it's a turn on, turn off type of phenomena. It's an accumulation of cold over a period of time that cells start to leak, and if they get completely chilled and rechilled, these membranes that are on the tissue don't reorganize. And when they don't reorganize, they create channels, and those channels allow solutes to leak out of the cells, and it's on those solutes that secondary pathogens start to feed. So one of the ways to get the membrane to reorganize is to actually heat the fruit up slightly. So therefore, the reason behind storing them at a higher temperature is to allow those membrane and all of those proteins that are in that membrane to get back into the right order. And if we keep them cold and stored cold for a long time, the channels stay open. If you can warm them up, cure them, then the channels get closed. If you store them at the appropriate temperature, then the channels don't reopen. And as a result of that, that helps with the storage. So, you know, as we think about it, you got to think about it that way. And we'll just continue the discussion because I see we've got a caller.
We do. 1-800-826-1495. Also, upraccess@gmail.com, or you can tweet us your question or comment, hashtag AUGarden. Hi, we're talking with Barbara. Hi,
yes.
How are you doing, Barbara?
Hi. We are reviving an old cellar that's, you know, in the ground, storage cellar, root cellar, whatever they're
yep,
called.
Yep, that's right.
Okay. And so, and it worked for my in-laws for decades.
That's correct.
And okay, so it has steps, it goes down, it's a dirt floor, it does not have shelves or anything. What do we need to do? Do we put straw on the floor to put potatoes on? Do we, what do we do? Do we have to have bins, I assume, with some circulation or build some shelves?
Well, any of those things will work. I mean, the two things that you're worried about is if you actually put them down on the ground and if you don't know whether the cellar floor gets wet or not during the winter months, that's something that you have to be a little bit concerned about. So normally we would say, you know, pallets down on the floor or something like that
okay.
to get produce off of the surface. You're going to have temperature gradients in that cellar as well. And generally what we would find is the earth temperature is right around that 50-degree mark. So things that like it a little bit on the warmer side should be stored closer to the bottom of the cellar, surprisingly. Because that's where the earth is warmest. You'll find that it gets colder as you go up, and the one way to do that is to have a few thermometers in the thing so that you can kind of track what the temperature is like as you're learning. And then really the best things to store in this are those things that like it a little bit on the cooler side. So things like your squash and stuff, yeah, they used to store them in there, but, you know, they were kind of paying attention to those things. But for potatoes, for onions, for cabbage, for carrot, for parsnips, for any of these crops that really like colder temperatures, the root cellar is a great place to have things because it has two things going for it. Number one is the earth temperature tends to be fairly stable, so that helps to hold it at an appropriate level. And because the earth is kind of humid, the humidity in the tunnel or in the cellar tends to be about right as well, so that the product doesn't deteriorate. Now, you just can't kind of stick things in there and walk away from and expect it to always be good. You know, you need to be watching what's going on with your product, gauging what your temperatures are in there so that you can kind of get plants into the appropriate zones so that they store properly.
Okay. So there is no water that gets on the floor. But, and of course, the people who used it went there a couple times a week in the,
that's right,
you know, decades past,
yeah,
because that's where things were stored. So they had apples until spring, they had potatoes until spring. So we can do the same thing just by maybe monitoring the temperature on the floor as opposed to partway up, right?
Well, yeah, what you really want to know is kind of what your temperatures are like. I mean, you haven't used it before, so by doing a little bit of, you know, just watching what the temperature is like. I don't mean tracking it every day, but you could
right.
do something like that. You could get one of these radio-signaled ones, and that would tell you from the comfort of your kitchen what the temperature was in the center. But certainly once a week or so, or if you've had an extremely cold period during the winter, you know, go out and kind of see what the temperature is like in the tunnel. Or
okay.
in the cellar, because that's going to tell you whether you're going to potentially have some damage that can occur to the crops that you
right.
have.
Okay, now they did store squash, but that's just because that's what they had. But ours needs to go in the furnace room or someplace much warmer.
Yeah. Ideally, it's not the best place, these root cellars. You know,
okay.
It's close to the, you know, temperature, ground temperature, earth temperature at about 4 to 5 feet is about 50-some degrees, 51, 52 degrees, up to 55 degrees maybe. And so it's kind of close for squash, but I think when they had it, they probably had places in there that they knew were warmer, and that's why, because you don't know enough about the site, doing a little bit of investigative work by having a thermometer in there and kind of just watching what's going on with the temperature can start to help you say, oh yeah, it is colder up high in the cellar, or it's warmer over in this area of the cellar, and then those become places that you're going to start to store. And then they also probably put straw on it and did things like that, because what tissues do is they respire, and one of the byproducts of the respiration product is heat. And so by insulating things with straw or with other insulating materials, what that does is that heat builds up around those tissues and keeps it from getting too cold, and then allows it to store for a longer period of time.
Okay, is there any problem storing, let's say, apples and onions in the same room? I mean, you know, sometimes at home you put things in a bag to get them to ripen better. I mean, would that make the apples spoil faster or not?
No, the problem that you have with storing different products is that with apples and potatoes together, ethylene causes sprouting in potatoes.
And
that's from the apple. So the apples naturally generate ethylene. If you store carrots in there, ethylene causes root formation on the carrot. So you may get sprouting of, you know, these little white roots that come off of your carrots.
Right.
The
only thing to do then is go in there often enough that you take the sprouted stuff out, use it first. Or the potato with eyes, use them first.
That's right. And you just, you know, you're going to have to deal with these things because we're going to commingle a lot of different crops that do a lot of different things in there. Just understanding that these are going to happen, and there's really not any way to isolate them from each other. And that's just, you know,
right.
There's nothing you can do about it, but you just have to pay attention to what's going on.
Okay, so the ethylene is down there. It's circulating. Okay, when you open a door, let's just say you had a nice day in January.
Yep.
Would you open the door and leave it open for a little while to let some of that ethylene gas out?
The ethylene gas is going to be there regardless. You know, so it doesn't matter all the other times that it's closed. It's during that period when it's closed that it's the problem. You know, so the plants are being bathed in this, and so you'll see discoloration that occurs and things. If you're storing cabbage, the outer leaves will start to yellow quite noticeably, and that's a response to the ethylene. So, you know, you can't get away from it, so don't lose any sleep over it. That's just the way it is, and just be using those products that are sprouting a little on the earlier side, and it's not going to harm you, and I don't know any other way to solve it other than say don't store ethylene-producing compound or plants with those that are sensitive to it.
Yeah, but those are the ones we like.
That's right. And
yeah.
So
Thanks
we just
lot.
Live with it.
Yep.
Okay.
Bye.
Thanks Barbara.
If you'd like to join our conversation, it's 1-800-826-1495. Email us your question, upraccess@gmail.com. Or you can also tweet us your question, #AUGarden. Now, Dan, ethylene gas, how is it lighter than air, or does it sink? I'm just thinking, well, maybe if it sinks, you can put your other stuff further up off the floor, but I don't know.
But the concentration in the air that plants react to is really low.
So it doesn't matter.
If you've got apples in there, they're generating way more ethylene than all these other crops really like. So, you know, if you're a plant physiologist, you know, you would say, okay, better to have two cellars, one for your ethylene generating plants and one for your non-ethylene generating plants. That's why we're supposedly have these things vented, because the venting on your root cellar is designed to allow the escape of humidity to allow for, you know, kind of this, you know, breathing that needs to be done. It allows for some of those gases to escape. But, you know, nobody ever built more than one root cellar. They were a chore to build. So they would build a big enough one to kind of store everything. And then you just kind of work your way through and consume what's there and understand that you're going to have a few of these things that occur. And it affects some crops more than others. And that's why with carrots, you know, it causes root sprouting. It also causes some bitter compounds to occur in those ones. And what did most gardeners do? They do what you do. You put leaves and bags of leaves over top of your carrot beds and leave them right in the ground out in the vegetable garden. And then when you need carrots, you go out and dig them up. And that becomes your storage site rather than digging them all up and moving them down into the cellar.
They taste better that way anyway.
Well, they'll taste equally good, I mean, if you didn't have the ethylene there. So, and yeah. with the cabbage, the way my father handled it was, you know, pull the cabbage up, you know, dig a trench, turn them upside down, and stick them in there so that the roots stuck up so that he knew where it was, piled the straw and things like that over top of them, and then that became the storage site for him. So then the leafy part of the plant didn't freeze. It was buried in the ground, and he knew where they were because the root system was sticking up in the and that was a way of solving those things rather than using our fruit cellar, which was a earthen cellar as well.
And it's cold enough that you don't have the process of the leaves rotting.
No, that's exactly right. It's still very, very cold, and you know, these earthen cellars are really very, very nice, are very efficient. They have good humidity because they're tied to the earth. They have good temperature regulation because they're tied to the earth. They're much easier to manage. They're often big enough that you can get into. And then it just becomes a matter of, you know, kind of making sure that that you're paying attention to what's going on there, because there's always deterioration that's occurring. And the more product that you have that deteriorates, and if it's touching another fruit, then that organism just starts to move into the next fruit, and then it moves into the next fruit, and that's where all the waste occurs. So you have to kind of be paying attention to these cellars, and you just can't walk away from them and expect to kind of go in and then have everything really good until springtime. They're a little work, and they take a little bit of management, and they take some observation, and they take some learning, and those are all things that our listeners are quite capable of doing if they have the right information, and that's why we're talking about it.
I sure wish I had one of those old root cellars.
I kind of, in many ways, wish I do too, but I have a coal room that gets pretty cold because it's open to the outside, and the old steel, you know, door that they had on it where they shoved the coal down in, you know, is not very well insulated, and I kind of leave it that way because we store quite a bit of stuff in there, and it stays pretty darn cold, and all my apples and that kind of stuff that I get go in that place, and it does its job, and it does it really reasonably well, and so, you know, in many ways that's a good thing. And I think, you know, the local builders, and by putting these fruit rooms in, you know, kind of, you know, trying to maintain some of that, yet with some of the modern conveniences of being accessed from the house so that you don't have to, you know, trudge out in the snow, dig out the door, climb down in it, you know, the spiders and everything else that are down in there that are living, you know, and yet you have less problems with, you know, rodents and those kinds of things that, you know, kind of are looking for a nice place to go for the winter. So you have to kind of be aware that there's all of these other things that are also saying, well, here's a good food source. You know, how do I, you know, mitigate, you know, mice and things like that from getting into my fruit cellar when I have one of these in? And it's management, it's paying attention, and it's kind of watching what's going on, and it's prepping for that.
Well, we've reached the halfway point of our program. You're going to listen to the next edition of Wild About Utah. It's just coming right up, and then we'll be back with Dan Drost, USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist. So be calling or tweeting or emailing your questions, and we'll be waiting for you.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan.
now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Wild About Utah, a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio.
Hi, this is Mark Larez Casanova from the Utah Master Naturalist Program at Utah State University Extension. It is amazing to see just how much of an impact the large snowfall from last winter still has on the annual cycle of nature. Of recent note, wildflower blooms in the mountains seem to be at least 2 to 3 weeks behind normal schedule. Hiking through snow in late July had me thinking about colder times when Utah's mountains were covered with ice that flowed as glaciers. The most recent period of glaciation in Utah occurred between 30,000 and 15,000 years ago when Utah's climate was, on average, up to 30 degrees Fahrenheit cooler. At times during this period, much of the western half of Utah was covered by Lake Bonneville, which contributed tremendous amounts of moisture as snow throughout Utah's mountain ranges. As the snow accumulated at high elevations, its sheer weight caused it to recrystallize into ice. Once the masses of ice became heavy enough, gravity pulled them downslope, carving out characteristic U-shaped valleys. At the top of the valleys, where the glaciers formed, we can often find large, bowl-shaped cirques. In the Wasatch Range, the Little Cottonwood Canyon Glacier formed at the top, creating Albion Basin, and reached the mouth of the canyon where it calved icebergs into Lake Bonneville. The Uinta Mountains contain such large glaciers that even many of the mountain peaks are rounded. As temperatures warmed during the end of the last ice age, glaciers receded and left behind large piles of soil and rocks known as moraines. Terminal moraines at the end of a glacier's path can act as natural dams to create lakes. Enormous boulders, known as glacial erratics, can often be found discarded along canyons. So while glaciers don't currently exist in Utah, there are several permanent snowfields in shaded high mountain areas. So if you're feeling a little nostalgic and missing that extra long winter we had this year, you still have a chance to hike up above 9,000 feet and cool your toes in the snow. For Wild About Utah, I'm Mark Larez Casanova.
Wild About Utah is a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio. For transcripts and archived audio of Wild About Utah, go online to upr.org and click on the Wild About Utah link. Support for Wild About Utah comes from the College of Natural Resources at Utah State University. Information is at cnr.usu.edu.
Support for Utah Public Radio is provided by the 10th Annual Moab Folk Festival, November 2nd through 4th, featuring artists Sarah Hickman, Willie Porter, Elin Jewell, and among others, along with food vendors and arts and crafts from around the globe. More information is at moabfolkfestival.com.
Welcome back to the second part of Access Utah today. Dan Drost, USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist, is our guest, and we hope that you'll join us by calling with your question at 1-800-826-1495. That's 1-800-826-1495. Or also email us your question, upraccess@gmail.com, or tweet us your question at #AUGarden. Dan?
Are we live?
I think we're live. The red light's not on, but I think we're live.
Yeah. And how would we know if we were?
Well, I guess if somebody calls in, we'll know for sure.
So we need someone to call in. So Tom, are you listening? Or somebody like that can just verify whether we're live or not. We don't know if we have a technical glitch.
We have somebody calling in.
Okay.
There we go. All right. So let's go back to our potato harvest. I've... you know, of course, learning from this program that I'd been storing my potatoes in the wrong place. So I put them in to my warmer storage rather than the colder storage. I have one of those coal chute rooms that works great, that's insulated on the inside of the house but not up against the wall. That works great. But the one next to it is insulated all the way around, and that stays a little warmer, so I put them in there. But I'm also hearing from you in between the program that it all depends on what you do with them. So.
Well, yeah, you got to remember that, you know, if we're with potato, it's basically starch that we're storing. And if you bring those potatoes and put them into a really cold area that's, you know, 40 degrees or less, they will store a lot longer under those conditions. That's quite appropriate for them to be stored. However, there's a conversion that occurs within it, that the starches start to break down and produce sugars. And if you're into eating baking potatoes, then what we find out with the baking potatoes is that there's a lot more sugar. And some people say, oh, I can taste the sweetness of this potato. Why is a potato sweet rather than starchy? And if you are into frying potatoes, making French fries, or let's say you make your own potato chips, or, you know, you do things like that where you're going to be frying these fried potatoes. I do a lot of those, you know, for breakfast type things or something. And then you'll get them, they brown really fast and they have this really strong sugar flavor to them that may be somewhat undesirable. So by storing them at warmer temperatures, and by warmer we mean around 45 degrees, maybe up to 50 degrees, we get less of that conversion of starch to sugar, and they maintain their more starchy characteristics, and then they're going to be equally good for baking or for frying without getting too much color development. And the color development that occurs through the frying process is because starches color at a much higher temperature than sugars do. So you get that caramelization that goes on. We all know about that, and that occurs at a lower cooking temperature. And so they brown very quickly, but they may not always cook through as quickly. And so, you know, you keep cooking them for a longer period of time, they just get darker and darker, and you kind of ask yourself, well, that isn't really what I like. So I store potatoes when I buy them, and I've gotten a bigger bag this year. We just store them where it's warmer. Once again, it needs to be dark, because if it's not dark, what happens with potatoes is they start to color, and you get that green color, and that's chlorophyll, and the chlorophyll is bitter. And we don't really like that. It's not going to hurt you too much. Some people are more reactive to it, but you don't like that green color. That's not what we want. And so that's why potatoes are stored in brown bags often, so that the light can't get through to cause this greening color.
Okay, so as far as harvesting the potatoes, when you first dig them up, they're just, you know, they're kind of sensitive as far as the skin. How long should you, I guess, cure them, for lack of a better word?
Well, generally, you know, the potato harvester guy would dig them and bring them straight into the storage room, and then he will store them at a really warm temperature, about 65 to 70 degrees, for, you know, up to a week. The idea being, what that does is it helps set the skin, and it starts to cause that skin to suberize.
Ooh, I love that word, suberize.
Yes, it's a term that basically says any wounds that were on it will start to heal over. And it also creates that hard, impervious skinning to the thing that keeps it from dehydrating. So, you know, that's important for us as we're thinking about just storing these potatoes. The appropriate temperature, if you like more brown colors, store them a little cooler. If you want more starchy flavors, store them a little warmer. Make sure it's in the dark. Keep them in the dark. That's a key thing, so that they don't green up. And then when you're digging, make sure that they sit for a few days at a warm temperature so that the skins can set or suberize.
Well, you're a popular guy. We've got
called out, and I said, you know, look at me.
Okay, so we're going to go from Millville, then to Providence, and then to Brigham City. So we'll start with Derek in Millville. Hi, Derek. How can we help?
Hey, yeah, I decided I'd try some Brussels sprouts this year.
Uh-huh.
And I bought the starts, and I put them in the ground in, early May.
Yep.
And they did great for a while. And then the aphids started really getting at them.
Yeah.
So I bought some spray at one of the garden stores, and the spray took care of the aphids pretty good. But then as the summer got hotter, they really started looking bad, and I didn't think they were going to pull out of it. They were a really good-sized plant.
Yep.
But now that it's gotten started to get colder again, they've really shot up and gotten even bigger, but I still haven't got any Brussels sprouts off of them. I'm just wondering, should I give up on them and pull them out, or should I let them go?
Let them go, and I'm going to give you a clue that I want you to do today or tomorrow. I want you to go out and cut the top 2 inches out of the plant.
Okay.
So the top 2 inches.
Okay.
So that's basically going to take the growing point out, because now what they want to do is they just want to start growing taller and taller. So what you're going to do is stop them from growing taller by cutting the top out of them, and just use your shears or go in with a sharp knife or something like that and just chop it out. And then all of that energy is going to go into those side buds that are going to produce the sprouts.
Okay.
Now, normally we would do that somewhere around mid to late August. And then the sprouts will start to swell through September and into October, and then you start harvesting toward the end of October. Now, the sprouts might not get very big because you're doing it a little on the late side, but they will do it.
Okay? And then they also, the aphids are starting up again. Should I spray them again?
Yeah, you probably can. And just look at the label of whatever you bought and see what the interval is from spray till when you can harvest. And it should say, you know, you can eat the product within 7 days of spraying or something like that. You know, so that will tell you, okay, I can't spray, you know, if you're going to harvest tomorrow and it said 7 days, that means I can't harvest tomorrow. I got to wait a week.
Right.
Does that make sense?
The harvest will be at the end of October, or should be at the end of October-ish.
Well, they'll start to size by then, and I always have left my Brussels sprouts when I grow them. I just leave them in the garden, and I leave them in there till November, till early December, because the longer and the more cold they get, the sweeter they become.
Oh, good.
Yeah, so you can just leave them out in the garden. Just take the growing point out of them. That's where you're cutting the 2 inches off. And now all that energy will go into those side buds, and you'll get some. They won't probably be very big, but they should be very sweet. And then they should be sized up enough by the end of October, and they'll continue to size through the autumn. They like the cold. They grow well in the cold. They'll do just fine. Just leave them out in the garden.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay.
Thanks, Derek. That's interesting. You're supposed to do this.
Yeah, you know, the commercial farmers do it. That's how they get all those nice uniform buds. And we've never really talked about Brussels sprouts.
We haven't. And I've got a volunteer that came up from last year.
Yeah, and what happens is they just keep growing the main growth. The main axis is a strong one, so they don't put a lot of growth on the side buds. And so the commercial farmers basically top them. So they go through
mid-August.
Mid to late August, that's when they start to want to put some effort into the secondary buds, and so they'll take the growing point out of them. So those of you that are Brussels sprout growers in the future, you know, about the last week of August, that's the best time to do it. That's when I've always done it, and it does a great job. It grows big sprouts then, and they progressively develop from the bottom of the plant upward. So oftentimes, you know, if Derek's still listening, you know, you'll start picking your buds off the bottom of the plant, and the ones toward the top of the plant will just continue to size over time. And so you can just leave them out in the garden. And then mid-December or something like that, you know, when it gets really cold, you know, pull up the plant or chop the plant off and throw it in your garage and then use them as you need to.
It's like they're full of antifreeze. They just do so well.
Yeah, they build
cold.
Up the sugars in there. There's these specific sugars that form in cabbage-type plants that act as antifreeze. Exactly right. And sugar does that.
Well, our next caller is from Providence. We have Eric. Hi, Eric.
Hello.
Thanks for holding on. How can we help?
I had a couple of cucumbers in the garden this summer, and I got their burpless variety. And I got plenty of cucumbers, but I didn't get a one that could be eaten. They were so bitter. And I'm wondering if shading would help, or maybe a different variety, or what can you do about that?
Well, the temperature problems that we had this summer where it was really, really high, I noticed that in my own. Two things that you can do. Most of the bitter compounds are in the green skin, so you can peel them, and that will take off a lot of that bitterness. But some people, and you might be one of those, that's a little bit more sensitive to some of those compounds, and those compounds are called cucurbitacins. It's a specific name for these bitter toxins that the plant produces. They're supposedly repel insects and things like that, but there are insects that can tolerate them as well, as you know that. Cucumber beetle is one of those. But you just may be a little sensitive to them, so peeling them helps. The other thing is shading will help, because one of the problems that we have under high temperatures and warm days and warm nights in particular is more of these compounds form in the fruits. So, okay. And then the other thing is make sure that they never get water stress. So, you know, sometimes we get a little water stress on the plant and that will cause problems.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Thank
Good
you.
Luck with that.
Thanks for your question. And then we go to Brigham City and we have Deanne. Hi, Deanne. How can we help?
Hi, my question is about beets, how to store beets and for the winter, or can you store them?
Yeah, Brian's over here rubbing his belly. He's looking forward to having beets all winter, too. The best thing to do is pull them up, trim off most of the leaf, leave a little bit on, you know, it doesn't hurt any, and then they should be stored cool and moist. So if you've got your fruit cellar, the cold one, store them in there. Stick them in something and put if it's in a bucket or in a container, you just want to maintain high humidity because they do dry out a little bit over time.
Okay.
So very cold. The colder the better. That's the best thing. No leaf on them because the leaves continue to transpire water, and that'll just pull it right out of the beetroot, and that causes them to shrivel up pretty fast.
Should they be dug before frost?
It doesn't matter. They will tolerate the frost quite nicely, so when you think they're appropriate size or you think it's getting too cold and you're not going to be able to get them out of the garden or something, they could stay in for another month and it won't hurt them at all.
Oh, okay. That's great.
Okay. Good luck with that.
Thanks, Deanne.
Thank you.
Take care. All right. Now, I just did this purely by laziness because I never got around to digging them up, but I usually have my beets in the same row as my carrots, so I just decided I'm going to take a bag of leaves and put them over the top of the beets. It worked.
Yeah.
But the flavor did change, probably because of more sugars building up in there.
Absolutely.
But they stored really quite well in the garden, too.
Under those cold conditions, you'll get these sugars that start to build up in the tissue, and that creates kind of this sweetness. The one nice thing about storing them right out in the vegetable garden is that it's easy, and they don't dry out as much, whereas when you pull them up and you just have that root exposed, over time, water is lost both out of the root itself, and some people store them with the tops because they like to eat beet tops, and, you know, fried beet tops are really good. And so they want to have both aspects of that, and having all that leaf tissue, they just dry out that much faster because they're still losing water through the leaf tissue. And so you just have to understand that that's what's there. So some people will stick them in a bucket, leave the tops on them, put sand in the bucket, and then add some water to the sand to create a more moist environment so that those plants will just take up some of the moisture through their root system and transpire it out the tops and then put them in their cellar that way. So if you don't mind going through a few extra steps, you can do that.
So carrots, if you decide to dig them up, should be handled the same way, take the tops off?
I mean, oftentimes the commercial farmers, how do they store their carrots? They actually wash them and stick them in plastic bags and then seal that plastic bag, but they do have a small number of perforations in the plastic so that some of the humidity can escape. So, you know, you could stick them in a garbage bag and then just take a pencil or something like that and poke some holes in the plastic of the garbage bag and stick it in your cold room, and that's a good way to store it. That way they stay hydrated. They like to have moisture, you know, like 95% moisture content or humidity around the root system, and that's the way they will store the best, and that's a simple way to do it. Commercially, the farmers do that. They store them in plastic bags. That's why we buy them in plastic bags. Mm. I mean, they've got them dug and packaged, and they're just sitting in a warehouse someplace under cold, humid conditions until they get distributed to the grocery store.
Okay, so now in the last couple of minutes that we have left, first, plant your garlic.
That's right. Don't forget to do that if you're a garlic person. Get those in. If you still haven't planted cover crops and you've got garden space and you want to plant your cover crops, it's safe to still plant something like winter wheat or some vetch. The vetch won't grow very much from here on out. It will sprout, but you won't get a lot of leaf growth out of it this fall, but you can still do that. If you like to plant some of the mustards or some of those kind of things, we don't recommend it. It's too late in the season for that. You don't get enough growth out of them.
What about winter peas?
Little too late for those two. Once again, you know, they'll sprout, but they sprout at, they, you know, just don't really establish themselves as well this late in the season. Now, that's for the northern part of the state. If you're down in, even in the central part, but if you're down in St. George region, you could plant any of those yet and still be good. Let's see. We didn't say anything about harvesting tomatoes.
Yes.
Okay, we got frost that's coming, right?
About 90 seconds.
That's okay. I don't need more than that. So the one thing we don't want you don't want you freeze your tomatoes out in the garden. You can cover them, but it'd be better to actually, anything that has color on it, to pick it before the frost and get it inside the house and store it in a warmer area, so around 50 degrees. And anything that has any trace of color will continue to color up for the remain, and that way you'll get the bulk of those fruits off of the plant.
What about those that have changed from a dark green to a light green?
Those would
haven't...
be the other ones that you could take, okay. But remember, they're going to taste more like those store-bought tomatoes that you have. And if you don't mind that, we've done it in the past, and I've had tomatoes all the way up till December by picking them now and then just storing them in the cellar. So I think that would take care of it.
And but they'll taste better to you because you grew them.
Well, you can always say that.
They actually
you can
do
always
or
say
not.
I'm still giving you tomatoes when you have guests over from my garden.
Yes. And they'll think, oh, these are wonderful.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, Dan, thanks for coming in.
It's
I do
a pleasure.
Appreciate it. You've been listening to Access Utah. Dan Drost is USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist, and he'll be our guest again next year. And, we had an email question from Valerie, and it was about carrots, so we got that one taken care of. So very good both ways. And thank you for joining us on this edition of Access Utah.
Add some instant color to your fall garden with pansies. I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Pansies are cheery plants that add color to the winter gardens in the south and spring and fall gardens in the north. Two relatively new introductions will allow you to cover more ground when planting this fall. Cool Wave pansies, introduced by Ball Horticulture, are a trailing pansy that can be used in the garden or a hanging basket. You'll need half the plants to cover the same garden space. I planted mine in October last year and had great results. They even weathered the first 2 months of our extremely hot summer. Try a basket full of white Cool Wave pansies, add some sunglasses, and you have a ghost for Halloween. Wonderfall is Syngenta's spreading pansy. Its large flowers come in shades of blue, lavender, purple, and rose. Pick up a few to include when planting your bulbs or other fall favorites. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
Utah Public Radio now makes it even easier to stay up to date with News at Noon on Twitter. This is April Ashland, UPR's social media coordinator, inviting you to follow and join the conversation about politics, local, and statewide events by going to twitter.com/Utah Public Radio.
Thank you for listening to Utah Public Radio. This is KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan. This is Utah Public Radio, Utah's favorite public radio station.
At Utah Public Radio, we discuss current events, social issues, gardening tips, politics, talk with local authors, and many other important Utah-related subjects. On Access Utah, an original program produced by Utah Public Radio, I'm Addison Pace, production intern for Access Utah. Join us weekday mornings 9 to 10, Utah Public Radio, Utah's favorite public radio station, for providing your access to things that matter in Utah.